Velina Kako, my name is Kehaulani Kauanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. This program features the political and cultural resistance of Indigenous peoples. On today's show, I have two different segments. The first will look at an ongoing Indigenous protest movement called Idle No More, in response to the Canadian federal government's ongoing abuses. The second segment of the show is also related to Canada, as we turn to a legal case called Daniels versus Canada, having to do with the legal status of Indigenous peoples classified as Métis and non-status Indians. I'll tell you more about today's topics and my three guests momentarily, but first I want to let listeners know that this show is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut. This location is also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. From wherever you are listening, I can receive emails with your feedback on the program. You can write to me at indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And for those wanting to catch up on past episodes, the audio archives are up and running on my website, where you can listen at your convenience. The address is indigenouspolitics.com. Now to Idle No More. Idle No More is an ongoing protest movement originating among the First Nations in Canada. Idle No More has consisted of hundreds of political actions worldwide, inspired in part by the hunger strike of Attawapiskat First Nation Chief Teresa Spence, and further coordinated via social media. This Indigenous resurgence is in response to governmental abuses of treaty rights by the current Conservative administration, led by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and passage of recent legislation that has gross implications for Native landholdings and the environment. Now, before I bring on my two guests to talk about this, I want to play a very short excerpt of a new video. It's called Idle No More, The Voice of a Movement, which you can find on YouTube. It's a short documentary, about 19 minutes, aimed to inform Canadians of the major pillars of the Idle No More movement. It was shot by Michael Anderson, a non-Indigenous law student, and includes the work of Native comedian Ryan McMahon. I'm going to play just the first minute because it gives a quick introduction to the movement.
On December 5th, 2012, Bill C-45 was passed in the Canadian House of Commons. Along with other sweeping changes, the new law altered how land is managed on Native reserves and removed protection of thousands of bodies of water. As the country's Indigenous peoples learned about the new law, they began to assemble, and a movement was born.
No more, stand up and raise your fist. We are the soul of the country, the reason it exists. Idle breeds evil, the people are not feeble. At the bottom of the pot is where they try to keep you. False information is what they gon' try to feed you. Keep telling us we're stupid, say they don't need you. Into the burning flames is where they try to lead you. Open up your eyes, Harper's lies are so see-through.
Every generation has its time, and every generation has its leaders, and every generation has its heroes. Every generation has all of that.
And yes, that's Idle No More. And speaking to that issue, I have two guests, Erica Lee and Dr. Alex Wilson. Erica Lee identifies as an urban Cree. She is a political philosophy student at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, Canada, and is a member of the Indigenous Student Council. Erica has been working as an Idle No More organizer since speaking at the first official rally in November 2012. She also works as an administrator on the Idle No More Facebook page, which currently has over 92,000 likes. Dr. Alex Wilson is from the Opaskwayak Cree Nation and is a professor and director of the Aboriginal Education Research Center at the University of Saskatchewan. Greetings, Erica Lee and Alex Wilson. Are you on the line?
Yep, Tassie. Hello.
Aloha. Thank you for joining me on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's great to have you on the show to share information with our listeners about the Idle No More movement in Canada and beyond. I'd like to start by asking if each of you could briefly introduce your backgrounds and also how you came to be part of Idle No More. Erica Lee, let's start with you.
I'm a student right now at the University of Saskatchewan, and I was asked to speak at the very first Idle No More rally, which was held back in November 2012 in Saskatoon here in Canada. and I was asked to speak by my high school teacher, Sheila McLean, who's one of the leaders of Idle No More.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
Hi. Well, I'm from the Opaskwayak Cree Nation, and I am a professor at the University of Saskatchewan here in Saskatoon. And I became involved a little later than Erica did, and there were four women that founded the Idle No More movement. And shortly after they started doing teach-ins in Saskatchewan and elsewhere, I became involved helping out Erica with the webpage, but also helping to organize some of the events in Canada and also the one in Los Angeles and planning for the one in Hawaii.
Oh, incredible. This has really taken off since November 2012 when it began. Could you tell what these protests are like and how they include also the round dance? That this might surprise some people who would think, well, what is this protest movement about? And the fact that it's grassroots. Erica, what was that first one like and how has it unfolded up there?
Well, the first rally was, it just actually just felt like another rally to me because there are a lot of us in this community who have been and communities all over the world and all over Canada who have been fighting for Indigenous rights for a long time and fighting for democracy and accountable government and the federal government. So there was just like 100 people at the center, and I remember it feeling good, but I don't remember it feeling any different. And then a few days later, we were contacted and asked to help plan rallies all over Saskatchewan in small towns. And then it spread to Canada and then the world. Some of the first rallies we held internationally was in California, where there was a lot of interest. And it was great to see all the solidarity from Indigenous peoples all over the world, because the issues we're dealing with right now, trying to get consulted by the federal government and trying to have our voices heard as Indigenous peoples of Canada, are issues that affect the same Indigenous peoples the same all over the world.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and I've seen solidarity acts from as far away as Aotearoa, New Zealand, to Palestine.
Right, and I guess I should mention, too, the round dances. We have flash mob round dances, and what that is a positive way to integrate a dance, you know, a First Nations tradition and a gathering. It's a way to make it positive. We're fighting for our rights, but we're also coming together as a community in a positive way. And it's important to, to portray ourselves in this way, because all we're doing is something that's completely peaceful, something that's completely about wanting positivity and growth for our country and our nations, our individual nations. And it's not about, smashing anything or smashing windows or starting riots. It's about coming together.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that really struck me when I first heard about the round dances was that they were taking place in malls. And I thought, how fantastic, the sight of excessive consumption and doing something that is so not about consumption. How beautiful. What prompted the movement? Alex, if we could start with you, if you could speak to the legislation that became sort of a trigger for this resistance.
Okay, well, I think even prior to the legislation, there has been ongoing erosion of the human rights of Indigenous peoples here in Canada and also of environmental protection legislation. And so people have been, working to educate one another on what's been going on. But in particular, in the past year, there has been a rapid increase in the amount of legislation that's trying to be passed. And we have these omnibus bills that were passed, Bill C-38 and Bill C-45. And so an omnibus bill is something that packs a whole bunch of proposed legislation into one packet. Mm-hmm. And they're, over 400 pages long. And Bill C-45 in particular was also attached to the Canadian budget. So this bill passed very quickly and without any consultation with Aboriginal peoples, and will impact our lives in a number of ways, and it will also impact the environment here in Canada.
Right. And that's linked in many ways to land expropriation, I understand, and also damage to the waterways. How is this linked to tribal sovereignty and governance and also corporate extraction of resources, including the oil pipeline?
Well, I think we see it as yet another thing that is giving privilege to corporations that extract minerals, that damage the environment, that pollute the water, that pollute the air, and that have historically had little negotiation or even respect for indigenous sovereignty, for indigenous land rights, and ultimately the impact is it erodes our treaty rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, and related to that, Erica, you mentioned earlier the issue of accountability and the government. Could you speak to what you see as the goal of the Idle No More protests?
Well, for me, the Idle No More, the goal of Idle No More and the movement is to raise awareness to spread knowledge about the things that have been going on to Indigenous peoples and the environment in Canada throughout our history. We've never really had our civil rights movement, almost. We've never had that opportunity to really talk about these issues. And now that there's so many First Nations people who are getting into universities, who are professors and who are students, and who are gaining positions of power, we actually have the opportunity to raise our voices and talk about this legislation, to fight back, whereas, you know, 20 years ago, maybe a lot of people wouldn't have had the opportunity to fight back or would have been shut down immediately. But we're growing strength in numbers, mm-hmm. and power and position. But there's still a lot of people, a lot of Indigenous people in Canada who are completely disenfranchised from the system. Mm-hmm. And so as academics and as people who have, have an opportunity to have our voices heard in forums like this, it's important for us to speak out for those who can't have their voices heard on these issues.
You know, some people might in the U.S. might not even realize that we weren't even considered humans under the federal law until 1960. So it wasn't until then that we were allowed to vote in Canada. So this movement has been a long time coming. And I think one of the things that Erica mentioned earlier about the energy of the movement is really important, because the time of, you know, people with masks and guns, mm-hmm. you know, that hasn't worked here. And so there's something really hopeful about this movement, because people who have been systemically marginalized from the political process, mm-hmm. youth, adults, elders, not just First Nations people, but many, many people in Canada, who are concerned about human rights and are concerned about the environment, now see Idle No More as a way to come together and kind of harness that energy that is evident in the world right now, and, you know, the shift to let's change things, and we can actually do something. And, you know, if we can have if we can come together in friendship and dance and also provide education while we're doing that, then it's just an amazing thing to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. I think, too, for people on the U.S. side of the border, the colonial imposed border, I think this has really exposed a different face of Canada for a lot of people. You've got settler Canadians basically saying, you know, quote unquote, our natives, we treat them so much better than the U.S. treats, quote, their natives. And, you know, these colonial governments are always kind of comparing and trying to prop up their own status in relation to each other. So I think that this has really ripped the face off of that.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, people have this impression of Canadians as, you know, just happy people that say A a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But this movement and some of the media that's gone along with it has really exposed that there's underlying racism, there's systemic forms of oppression, racism that link to sexism, homophobia, classism. All of those things are part of this colonial government that we live with, and it's exposed that. And it's not saying there's any more racism today than there has been, but at least now we're having the dialogue about it and we're starting to address it.
Right. And also, speaking of the media, I want to acknowledge, too, that one of the things that people down this way, if they haven't been tracking this from the beginning, may have heard about is the hunger strike, the 6-week hunger strike of Chief Teresa Spence that ended on January 23rd. I wanted to know if you could speak to, when she ended that hunger strike, the 13-point declaration that she and some of her confidants issued. Erica?
Yeah, Teresa Spence really kick-started the movement. It gave it a huge boost. And when she chose to go on that hunger strike to protest the conditions on her reserve, which is at Wapiskat, which is a notoriously poor reserve that lacks, you know, the basic necessities of life. These things occur in Canada right now. There's Indigenous nations that don't have running water or proper sewage disposal. And she went on her hunger strike to raise attention to these issues. And it was really interesting, the hate she received after a while from the media, comments about her weight, sexist and racist things being spewed out of the mouth of politicians, you know, who are supposed to speak for Canada, and they feel completely comfortable with paying her down as an Indigenous woman who's trying to make a stand for her rights and the rights of her people. So the 13-point plan she released when she stopped her hunger strike, the first point, I think, was the need for a better dialogue and better communication between First Nations, the government of Canada, and provincial governments. And I think that's one of the major aims of this movement, is to show that we haven't been properly consulted, to show that we need to talk about the treaties and what they mean today, to show that we need to talk about governance and what it means to have a truly nation-to-nation relationship.
That's right. And part of that consultation includes, or should include, I should say, the requirement for consent for any federal legislation that affects inherent sovereignty and treaty rights. What about that process up there in terms of these ongoing violations in a form of colonial domination that Idle No More seeks to address in regards to Indigenous peoples' consent?
Well, I think many people might not know this in the U.S., but in Canada we have, in our Constitution, Section 35 of our Charter says that Aboriginal people have to be consulted with anything that has to do with legislation that will impact us. And so this is one of the main reasons why people were mobilized to bring attention to these omnibus bills that passed, because there was not proper consultation that happened. And so this is something that the federal government really has to address, because in order for treaties to be recognized, validated, and acknowledged, and honored, consultation is definitely a part of that.
Mm-hmm. And also, I want to ask where the Assembly of First Nations fits into all this with regard to consultation and consent. In the Hawaiian case, for example, we have trustees of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs who are all too happy to sort of, bargain chip with our trust revenues and lands. Where is the Assembly of First Nations, and how do they interface with the Canadian federal government under Harper leadership and the grassroots?
The Assembly of First Nations is supposed to be a representative body of First Nations people in Canada and First Nations communities. And a lot of First Nations grassroots people have been critical of its ability to do that. And it's definitely a challenge right now in the Canadian landscape, and has been for a while. With Indigenous sovereignty, you know, every band and every tribe has its own ways of doing things, and they can't be denied those. I think that realistically, we need to have some way of communicating that and communicating our common shared experience as First Nations peoples in Canada to the federal government and to the Crown and to the people we deal with on a larger national basis. So the role of the Assembly of First Nations is supposed to be to represent the First Nations people, and often it definitely hasn't. So we need to, you know, look at, again, what we can do about that to enhance the communication between our nations.
That's right. Say what you think, where the direction is in terms of the protest. Is it getting stronger up there right now?
I think it's definitely getting stronger. And not just here in Canada, but we're seeing it getting stronger across the globe. And I think that's where we're going. People, you know, no matter where you are, where your listeners are, Think about the issues that impact you and your own community. So Idle No More is something that can be used to bring people together and unify around environmental issues and also human rights issues for Indigenous people. So it can also be tailored to the community and the specific needs there while providing solidarity and support for Canadian First Nations and Canadian environmental legislation. And I think the movement will continue to grow, and that's kind of the exciting part of it.
Okay, in conclusion, any thoughts that you'd like to leave us with? Erica?
I think that mostly Idle No More for me is about knowledge. So continuing in this the same vein we have with teach-ins, more than protests even now, is important for raising awareness among our own people and as well as non-Indigenous allies. That's one of the greatest strengths of this movement, I think, is that a lot of non-Indigenous Canadians are starting to see the effects of colonialism, starting to acknowledge our history, and that's very important.
And you, Alex, any closing thoughts?
I'd just like to thank everyone for their support, and also if they have an opportunity to check out our website, which is idlenomore.com. And there's an international event coming up, a Day of Solidarity coming up on Valentine's Day. And people can learn more about that by visiting the website or our Facebook page.
Okay, wonderful. Alex Wilson and Erica Lee, thank you so much for joining us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond to discuss Idle No More. It's been very inspiring, and the movement has certainly galvanized people all over. Mahalo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, listeners, that was Erica Lee and Dr. Alex Wilson speaking to Idle No More. And we're going to take a short break with a song by a band called A Tribe Called Red. This was just released as a new track in solidarity with Idle No More and Chief Teresa Spence. It is part of a compilation called Idle No More, Songs for Life, Volume 1, which is the first of an ongoing series of free downloadable compilations one can find online by artists who support the vision of Idle No More. After this, I'll be back with my other guest, Chris Anderson, to talk about another issue hitting Canada. We'll be right back.
Ma Lakota na iya waslo emataha. I'm Lakota and I'm from Standing Rock.
And I've got asthma.
Mom, Dad, Grandma, Grandpa, I know that you do all that you can to help me. But you might not know about all the different stuff that can make me have an asthma attack. Or all the simple things you can do to fight my asthma. Please don't smoke in the house or the car, because secondhand smoke triggers my asthma attacks. If you put my teddy bear in the freezer, it will wipe out the dust mites. And if you dry off my rubber duckies and bath toys, you will get rid of mold, all the things that can cause an attack.
These are just a few of the many things you can do to help your child fight their asthma attacks. To discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. A public service message brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Because I don't want to feel like a fish with no water.
Hello, I'm Byron Dorgan, and I worked on a lot of issues when I served as a U.S. Senator, but I am most proud of working to try to help American Indian children who have too often been left behind.
Hello, I'm Jacoby Ellsbury, center fielder for the Boston Red Sox, and a Native American. Native American youth experience the highest rate of youth suicide of any population in the U.S.
I created the Center for Native American Youth because we have to help these kids believe that anything and everything is possible for them. Visit our website at cnay.org to learn more.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I fight fires and I save lives.
My name's Renee. I'm a cardiologist. I save lives.
My name's Anthony. I'm an EMT. I save lives.
You don't have to be a professional to save a life. Firefighters, doctors, and others save lives. You can too. Don't wait. To learn more about the warning signs and how you can help prevent suicide, visit save.org. In a crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
And we're back on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. I'm your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. Now to the case of Daniels v. Canada. On January 8th, after more than 13 years of legal battle in the case, a Canadian federal court ruled that Métis and non-status Indians are Indians under a section of the Constitution Act and fall under federal jurisdiction. Judge Michael Phelan's ruling suggests that the 200,000 Métis and 400,000 non-status Indians should now fall under a particular form of federal jurisdiction. In his decision, Phelan noted that the decision would allow for a greater level of respect and reconciliation by removing the constitutional uncertainty surrounding these groups. In turn, Aboriginal Affairs Minister John Duncan issued a statement addressing the appeal and noted that it would be prudent for Canada to obtain a decision from a higher court to address the nuances. And now to introduce my guest. Dr. Chris Anderson is Métis from the Parkland region of Saskatchewan, located in Western Canada. He is an associate professor and associate dean of research in the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. He is currently the director of the Rupert Slind Center for Métis Research. Greetings, Chris Anderson. Are you on the line?
I am indeed.
Thank you for joining us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's really good to have you on the show.
It's nice to be invited.
Thank you. I wanted to ask if you could start by giving our listeners a bit about your personal and or professional background and how you come to do this research around the Métis.
Well, I was born in Saskatchewan, which is a fairly unpopulated province in Western Canada. I come from a very large Métis family, and when I went away to university, I started to get involved kind of at a more intellectual level on things that were going on in our community back home, and things kind of just took off from there.
All right. And you're working on a book about the Métis legal status issues, right?
Yes, I'm working on a book that is looking at how the Canadian courts and the census construct Métis identity in a way that isn't helpful for Métis nationhood claims.
Uh-huh, right. And with that, can you start now with the case, giving us some context for Daniels versus Canada in terms of the long legal battle? I read that this was 13 years in the making.
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, the Daniels case was about whether Métis and non-status Indians are included in federal jurisdiction under what's called Section 9124 of the Constitution Act. So Canada is a federal system similar to the United States, but historically, when the Canadian state was making decisions about who would have, quote, responsibility for the various indigenous peoples that were in the areas that it came to claim. It had to make a decision about whether or not they would be a federal responsibility or a provincial responsibility, which is kind of akin to state responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they decided under Section 91 of the Constitution Act was that they had responsibility for, quote, Indians and lands reserved for Indians. But the way that that has been interpreted by the federal government over the past 150 or so years is that it means they have responsibility for Indians on lands reserved for Indians. So basically, for the longest time, they argued that their responsibility for indigenous people at a federal level stopped at the edges of reserve boundaries, or what you folks would call reservation boundaries.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, go ahead.
Well, also, too, what does it mean for people who are unfamiliar with the question of a status versus a non-status Indian, and why are Métis classified as distinct from either of those?
So in Canada, in 1876, the federal government created what was called the Indian Act. And the Indian Act was, in essence, an omnibus bill, a bill that sort of took together previous chunks and pieces of acts that they had used to govern certain classes of indigenous people. And so what the Indian Act basically said was that any indigenous person who was identified or categorized as a status Indian had the same legal status as a child. So couldn't drink, couldn't hold a professional job, had their lives controlled in all kinds of ways by Indian agents while they were living on reserve.
Mm-hmm.
But the Indian Act was predictably quite racist and very patriarchal. And so one of the provisions of the Act meant that status Indian women, so if you fell under the Act, if you were considered an Indian under the Indian Act, you were what was called a status Indian because you had Indian status. And so what that meant basically was that because of the sexist or patriarchal provisions of the Act, Indian women could lose their status in all kinds of ways that men couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major ways that status Indian women lost their status was by marrying a non-status man, whether that non-status man was Métis, whether that non-status man was an American Indian, or most usually if that non-status man was a white person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So over time, that created two different populations. It created a population of status Indians, so people who lived under the Act and received benefits and various types of surveillance and intervention based on the Indian Act, and those who were cut out of the Indian Act and lived off reserve. Because one of the other stipulations under the Indian Act is that if you weren't an Indian, if you lost your status, you couldn't live on a reserve anymore. You had to move off reserve, and they didn't really care where you went.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that created two populations, a population of Indians and a population of non-status Indians, or status Indians and non-status Indians, if you want. Métis are separate from that, although the Canadian context is kind of every bit as complicated as the U.S. context. Métis are a group of indigenous people, a nation of indigenous people that basically sprung up on the western plains, were a post-contact people like several indigenous peoples in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it worked in Canada was the federal government argued that Métis were a provincial responsibility, that whatever obligations or duties were owed to Métis were satisfied in the late 1800s based on on what was called a scrip system, which is fairly similar to the allotment system that was used in the United States.
Mm.
And so basically what happened was that the Métis, because we were considered a provincial responsibility, whenever something came up around hunting or fishing or harvesting of any kind, the federal government and the provincial government used to treat us like a hot potato, throwing back and forth who was responsible for us. So what the Daniels decision basically does is the Daniels decision says for the first time that Métis are in fact a federal responsibility.
Right. Okay, so that's the distinction, because so much of the media that I read said, they're finally Indians.
Yeah.
Talking about the relationship.
Yes, that's an important point that you bring up, actually, because the court decision, the Daniels decision, is not saying that Métis are Indians under the Indian Act. They're saying that the term Indian in 1867 means the same thing as how we would use the term Aboriginal today.
I see. I see. And then what is the legal limbo then? Because part of what some of the media that I read, you know, talked about this ruling as a game changer and saying that in the jurisdictional limbo, is that political hot potato you're talking about in terms of giving it to the you know, the provincial government?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, a lot of people are sort of talking about how this is a game changer. I don't see it as a game changer yet, and perhaps it's because I'm cynical about the way that appeal court decisions treat progressive lower court decisions in Canada, as in most jurisdictions. But the federal government has just appealed the court decision, and it'll likely be another kind of 4 or 5 years before anything comes out of the Supreme Court of Canada.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, but possibly, if this goes all the way forward, it could certainly be a game changer. It could lead to arguments, you know, it could lead to something like, for example, some type of legislative modern-day treaty between Métis and the federal government, some type of, you know, Métis Nation agreement with the federal government. But it'll be a while before we can make those kinds of claims. And, you know, you hear various people talking about how this is going to cost the Canadian government billions of dollars, and I think those are pretty irresponsible comments to make at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did see in reports saying that it would almost double the population of Indians, quote-unquote, in Canada as defined under the Constitution Act, and that settlers were worried about the implications for them as taxpayers.
Indeed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, can I go back to something then you mentioned? You raised the prospect of being able to negotiate treaties with the federal government. Mm-hmm. Right now, though, what is this supposed constitutional uncertainty regarding the groups?
Ooh, that's a that's a tricky question. In 1982, Canada patriated its Constitution Act, and in Section 35 of that Constitution Act, they listed three Aboriginal peoples, Indians, now called First Nations, Métis, formerly called half-breeds and Métis, and Inuit, who were formerly called Eskimos.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was, when they created that that kind of constitutional status, they never defined what those terms actually meant. So it wasn't a big deal in the context of First Nations or Inuit, because they already fell under federal jurisdiction, so they had a fairly good sense of what that meant. But it was a huge deal in the context of Métis, because, of course, many of the people who were status Indians and who became non-status Indians are kinship-related to Métis, because we were all involved in the larger fur trade in Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these people who one person can call themselves an Indian as a legal category, another person would call themselves Métis as a legal category, but they may even come from the same family.
Right, right. In some reports, they were giving examples of Métis growing up in households where, say, half-siblings on reserves had access to different kinds of rights that they were denied. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and this is something that goes all the way back historically to when the Canadian state made decisions about who was going to be an Indian and who was going to be a half-breed. They, in many parts of Canada, they didn't care. You could pick whether, and you weren't being asked to pick whether you were an Indian or a half-breed. You were being asked to choose whether you wanted to be on a reserve or off a reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were someone who ran a fur trade and you were a trapper, of course you wouldn't want to be stuck on a reserve. Conversely, if you were someone who had sick children, you might want to be on reserve because there was promise of various types of medical provisions.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, these kinds of kinship links, where there was no strong division between either of them, over 4 or 5 generations, you start to see the investment into these various legal categories.
I see. And speaking of that on and off reserve distinction, the ability to make treaties, I mean, one report I read said that would mean that Métis, if this goes all the way up and, say, were to succeed as a case and not be overturned at the appeal stage, what would that mean for off-reserve Métis?
Well, almost all Métis are off-reserve. There's in Alberta, actually, where I live and work right now, they have what are called Métis settlements, which are kind of broadly analogous to reserves, but they're provincial jurisdiction rather than federal jurisdiction. But most Métis live off-reserve already.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, I'm sure that this could lead to some type of political relationship to pieces of territory or land. But most Métis in Canada are urban. I think we're about 70% urban right now. So this isn't going to cause a rush of people, you know, to these reserves that are, you know, hours and hours away from cities. It would probably be more likely to lead to something like, and of course this would all be negotiated with the usual kind of proviso of whatever power politics were at play. Mm-hmm. But it could lead back to something like a percentage of oil and gas revenues that are coming out of a particular area, increased negotiation rights for what resource extraction would look like, protection for various types of hunting, fishing, and harvesting that go on in various territories. We do have good templates for this, because they've been doing this in the Northwest Territories and in the Yukon with the various comprehensive land claims that have been going on there since the 1970s.
Mm-hmm, right. So that would be the supposed respect and reconciliation piece that I've seen sort of being mooted.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the part of the issue here is that people are talking about, well, why would Métis want to be Indians? Look how bad it's been for the Indians. And you would want to say, well, yeah, sure. If this leads to the creation of another Indian Act, of course that's terrible. But it doesn't have to. One of the things we know about colonialism is that settlers get to choose when and how they have relationships with Indigenous people. This gives a basis for a more equal, a more kind of equitable, fair discussion about what a future would look like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think the best case scenario would look like in that case?
That's a good question. I mean, the best case scenario would be that the federal government makes a decision in the short term rather than the long term, which they won't. But it would be for them to make a decision to enter into formal political negotiations with the Métis National Council, which is the main political body for the Métis Nation in Canada, with representatives from the federal government and have a discussion that comes out of that. I'm less interested in sort of pinpointing what that would look like, but in terms of procedural issues, that's what a fair process would look like.
Mm-hmm.
That would be best case scenario in my mind.
Something bilateral.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With mutual consent.
with mutual consent, and with the ability to pull out of things if it turns out it's not working.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you mention resource extraction, right?
And certainly, because many of the traditional territories are Métis, where the Métis lived, have become prime resource extraction areas for oil, gas, timber, minerals, diamonds, you name it.
Right. Well, it was sort of linked to that, I think. What about the numbers issue? I mean, are there status Indians that are worried about this if this case was to be, successful in terms of the numbers? Because I've seen people saying, that could be, 600,000 additional, people recognized with this federal relationship.
Yeah, I haven't seen very much of that, actually. I mean, to their credit, status Indian leaders and political representatives haven't kind of bought into this zero-sum game mentality. And they certainly might have in the past, because the federal government has certainly given them signals that it is a zero-sum game. But for status Indians, they've already undergone several influxes of new people back into their enrolled band membership list, right? You had Bill C-31 in 1985, which was meant to correct the gender discrimination of the Indian Act, and that led to something like 100,000 women and their families gaining their status back.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had to deal with that already. And then more recently, we've had Bill C-3, which has attempted to correct for the gender discrimination that was still left over in Bill C-31. And so that has led to thousands of new people making claims as well. So there is kind of a precedent for them sort of shouldering this additional load that comes with new people coming in who quite legitimately deserve to be there. So I haven't seen a lot in that context. I think one of the bigger issues, and it could be just because I'm a census geek, is what's going to happen now on the census when people... The question on the census says, are you a North American Indian, that is, First Nations, Inuit, or Métis? Now with the Daniel decisions coming out, it'll be interesting to see whether or not people who might formerly have checked off Métis now check off First Nations or Indian.
I see, right. And also, too, you said earlier about the case, it sounded like you're pretty certain that the federal appeal would be successful, meaning that the case would sort of die out. Is that, did I understand you right there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm trained a lot in sociolegal aspects of law, but when you read the original court decision, there are kind of countervailing lines of precedent out there that would challenge the arguments that the judge has made at this lower court level. I do think, I mean, I will say that when people sort of make arguments about what the end effect of this case is absolutely going to be, they, you know, they have access to a magic eight ball that I certainly don't, because none of the lawyers out there are talking that way. I think worst case scenario is it gets turned over, because there are other court cases that have said, in fact, that Métis and Indians have often been separate, and this idea that in kind of in certain instances they have been looked at the same shouldn't sort of take away from the fact that the main policy stance of the Canadian government was that quote-unquote half-breeds and Indians were separate. And in fact, part of the reason why they might say that is because Métis never got to sign treaties.
Mm-hmm.
Métis were given scrip, which is basically an individualized coupon for land, 240 acres, or you could take $240.
Oh, wow.
In fact, most of the wealth in Western Canada prior to oil came off the back of scrip speculation that divested Métis of something like 5.5 million acres of land and money combined.
Oh my goodness, I did not know that history.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, in terms of this kind of settler dispossession and land expropriation, before we brought you on the call, I had an interview with Erica Lee and Alex Wilson about Idle No More, and I wanted to get your opinion on the movement and the growing sentiments there and the protest that's gone global now in relation to what you said earlier about, you know, up until now, settlers getting to decide the settler prerogative, how to overturn that form of colonial domination.
Yeah, well, the I Don't Know More movement seems to have come out of nowhere for most settlers. But if our colleague Glenn Coulthard, who's a Dene at the University of British Columbia, has written a brilliant piece that sort of talks about the historical roots of where Idle No More came from, not the movement itself now, but kind of the social and material conditions that led to this movement. I think there's a couple of interesting things about the Idle No More movement that I sort of see that are kind of qualitatively different from previous movements. The most interesting one to me is the role that social media has played in this Idle No More movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about the Idle No More movement kind of most recently comes out of a recent slate of legislation that the current conservative government put through the parliament and is now going through the Senate with absolutely no consultation with Aboriginal people in Canada. And so this kind of flies in the face of a lot of court case logic that has come out saying that, you know, we need to negotiate, that Indigenous people and the Canadian state have to negotiate. And so this Idle No More movement has sort of kind of said, you know, basically that's enough. We're not putting up with this anymore. But the interesting thing about the Idle No More movement is that it's been largely an urban movement.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways in which I think it's become global, or one of the things that's played a large role in it becoming global, has been the use of social media. Has been Twitter, has been Facebook, has been various other devices that have been used. And we have a huge mall here in Edmonton. It's one of the largest malls in the world. I think they had 3,000 people go to the round dance that they had in the mall there. It'd be difficult to get 3,000 people to come to a round dance simply by, you know, calling people. So that's one thing. Another aspect of it is that this movement has really become and has really been a First Nations movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of effaced the kinds of dangers that are faced by Métis and are faced by Inuit as well. And I think part of the reason for that is that the kind of political rhetoric that is being used here is a rhetoric that Métis simply don't have access to, because it's been constructed in the context of what in Canada we call an abrogation of treaty rights.
Mm.
And since Métis never signed treaties, we're not really in a position to be able to add collective voices to the sorts of things that are going on. Even though these issues affect us, even though there are very prominent Métis who have taken a prominent role in the Idle No More movement in terms of organizing and that kind of stuff, it really has become a very First Nation-specific kind of movement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. Well, any parting thoughts you want to leave our listeners with in conclusion?
Well, I would say that Canada is not the snowy paradise north that everyone in the States likes to make it out to be. And I think that even though there are some interesting things that are afoot right now, we'll probably have to wait for a couple more years to see how these kinds of things shake out in practice, because, you know, the retrenchment will start immediately if it hasn't started already.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chris Anderson, for taking time to join us on Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond. It's really good to talk to you. Let me know when your book is out, hot off the press, and we'll be back in touch.
Excellent. Thanks very much for inviting me to talk.
Okay, mahalo. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And again, listeners, that was Dr. Chris Anderson, director of the Robertsland Center for Métis Research at the University of Alberta, where he is also an associate professor and associate dean of research in the Faculty of Native Studies. And for the remainder of the show, I want to leave you with two different songs. The first one is a track called Fly by Lorenzo, featuring Wab Canoe. I learned about this song from a colleague named Nigan Wewedon James Sinclair, who's been active with Idle No More protests. And he told me that this is the song that Lorenzo has been singing at many of the Idle No More gatherings, and that Wab Canoe has been a big figure in the movement. And Lorenzo, I should mention, has a track on that compilation also that I mentioned earlier, the one Idle No More Songs for Life Volume 1, which can be found online. It's a free downloadable compilation. And after that, in closing, I'm going to play you a new song in support of Samer Issawi. It's called Hungry, and it has been released by Doc Jazz. Samer Issawi is a Palestinian political prisoner held in Israeli detention, and he's been on hunger strike since August 1st. This song put out by Doc Jazz is dedicated to him, but also to other Palestinian political prisoners who are also on hunger strike. Doc Jazz put this online for free and has invited people to share the song widely via social media if they so wish. And so both of these songs go out in solidarity to these respective movements. I want to thank the stations that syndicate this program. Thank you for tuning in. Mahalo.
I just don't see why they don't want to let me be. All of my life I've just been trying to be free. I live the ups and downs, I see them every day. Sometimes I wish I could just break these chains and fly away. Well, they told me chasing dreams would only leave me all alone, broken in a million pieces, reaching for what's coming, gone. I never even stopped to think that maybe there was something wrong with that way of living. I just picked it up and carried on, try to walk a better road, reducing all the heavy loads that had me marching on a path directly onto heaven's door, feeling like a bird in a cage, burdened with rage. I picked up my pen and started hurting the page with each first that I write. Starts easing the pain, T3s. You know what I mean. It's my therapy, the flow start to take me away. Feeling pretty damn good to be Anishinaabe. It's a good day to live, but I was ready for the opposite. Alone I lived this life like nobody was watching it. But now I see the positive and try to carry on with the spirit of my people on my back. I'm feeling strong. Hey, I just don't see why they don't want to let me be. All of my life I've just been trying to be free. I live the ups and downs, I see them every day. Sometimes I wish I could just break these chains and fly away.
Whether you doubt me or crown me, I'll still be around you, keeping true friends around me while all my peeps crown me. People say they put me on or that they know all about me, but damn, that's like saying Columbus found me. People see my strength and then they want me on their side, but I don't let them conquer, cause I won't let them divide. Putting words in my mouth, of course, to their advantage, but why I'm speaking against homies is outlandish. Y'all know I have a problem when I'm speaking to your face. No one believes you anyways, cause you just reeking of disgrace. You dejected, disgruntled, and mad. I'm not huddled or not cowering down with all the rest of the masses. I'm empowered with sound, and then I'm kicking some asses, turning joints into ashes, and then I just passes like I'm passing you by. I'm too fast and too fly, an MC that makes change, not just asking you why. I just don't see why they don't want to let me be. All of my life I've just been trying to be free. I live the ups and downs, I see them every day. Sometimes I wish I could just break these chains and fly away. Wish I could just fly away, hey, 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 fly away, hey, 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 yo, hey, hey, yo, hey, hey, don't worry.
In the New York Times, almost 200 days without any bite, while I'm withering away in my prison cell. All you read about is the game of buy and sell in Wall Street. They don't know the way I resist. If they knew, they'd be shocked at the way I insist. Freedom and human rights are on my list. I wanna live, breathe, move. Hell, I wanna exist. If I had an army, I'd set it up to defend our villages, our towns till the very end. But I'm cut off from the world, so there's no supplies. They call resistance terrorism, but you know these are lies. If my eyes are blindfolded, my body in chains, tucked away behind bars, only thing that remains to refuse to be fed from a racist thief's den, to refuse to be treated like a sheep in their pen. I'm hungry for freedom and rights. I'm hungry, that's the way that I fight. I'm hungry, a prisoner on a hunger strike. Never charged, never tried by the damn Fourth Reich. What they say about my people. If there's one thing we ain't, it is sheeple. Why would we give up on our land and allow its theft? Because greed is their creed, there'll be nothing left. We want justice, how is that too much to ask? You won't touch this, cause you're not up to the task. Go ahead and lie, and call our enemy civil.